Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? Welcome to Waypoint Radio, a very special episode of Waypoint Radio that doesn't have a date yet because I don't know what the schedule will be when the embargo drops on this one. I'm Austin Walker. Patrick Klepek is here as always. And joining us, very special guest, the award-winning composer Austin Winery is here. Another Austin joining the podcast.
Oh, no. One is enough. Thank you.
One is too much. Let's be honest.
And yet, here we are.
And so, yeah, we're here. We're here to face disaster
together.
That is face or create disaster together. One of those.
Ooh, interesting. You're already selling us on the mystery of whatever your next project is.
Mystery. I think the mystery comes from the fact that I meet very few other Austins, and I always say the reason why is because of that plot from the horrible Jet Li movie, The One. Where he goes to parallel universes, killing the parallel version of himself because apparently there's like this universal amount of power and we're all normal humans because it's diluted amongst like 40 parallel versions. And as they die, you get more powerful. And it's obvious. I mean, it's just physics.
So, this is why we have to do this by Skype. We can't do this in person. It's too dangerous. I like to think that we'd hold ourselves back, but the temptation would be right there, you know? So
we keep each other accountable, that's for sure.
Austin, you and I actually first met 3 years ago. Almost, I don't know to the date, but it might be.
Actually, you want to know, it's almost exactly to the date.
That's what
I thought. I know because of my Facebook memories. Were reminding me that I was in New York,
perfect.
Like today, 3 years ago for
so it
Journey
was,
Live.
Literally, yes. So you were here for Journey Live, which was this incredible performance where you were conducting a live. How many people were in that performance?
It's an intimate show. It's like maybe 12 to 15 musicians, sort of a chamber orchestra.
Right. While another set of players performed the game live, not a video of the game, but we're playing the game live to the live scoring, which was a fantastic experience. And you and I got to speak a little bit about games and music and composition then, but that was 3 years ago. And so now I know you're working on new stuff. Stuff seems really interesting. You've worked on things since then. And we felt like maybe we should get together and chat a little bit about where you're at, what you're working on, and the state of game music and the state of games and the state of music, all that stuff. Whatever you want to talk about, we are here to talk about it. Maybe some
all horror. All those little existential, monumentally giant questions. Actually, ironically, just as proof of how far I've come, literally 4 days ago, I was doing Journey Live again somewhere in Colorado this time. So I'm apparently caught in a loop and the rest of the world has moved on.
I'm in a bigger room than the one I was in when I last did a call with you, but it is still red like the previous room. So I'm in the red room is what I'm saying, which is dangerous and ominous in itself.
Well, I hope you get married there and have an appropriate themed wedding.
A themed wedding, yeah. So let's jump into the new thing. Is that a place we can start? We'll get to other bigger questions, but I am eager to hear what you have to say about your next project, which is called Erica.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. It's really different than anything I've done because the game, I mean, it'll be obvious the moment anybody looks at even 1 second of it, because it's a film game, you know. The obvious comparison that people are going to make is say, oh, it's basically like Bandersnatch, which I think is a convenient shorthand, but it's actually a little bit it does a somewhat of a disservice to Erica, because I would say that Bandersnatch was basically an interactive film, and yeah. Erica is a filmed game. It's very much a video game. It's loaded with game mechanics, but it's just every second of it is built around, you know, actors and sets and cameras and props and all the things that we associate with movie making. So yeah, it is, but like Bandersnatch, it exists at this kind of intersection between, well, I guess what we could broadly call interactive media and traditional filmmaking.
Is it in that
way? Which made
way?
It crazy hard.
Oh yeah, I bet. Because there's different expectations, right? Like you open up Netflix and Bandersnatch is there, and I mean the "you" in that sentence is going to be way broader than people who play video games. But if Erica is being focused as a filmed game, the people who play games, like you said, there's mechanics they expect. There's more than just sort of one choice here or there. Can you give me the basics on what Erica is for people who haven't seen a trailer yet or who are only hearing about it now?
Yeah, sure. Well, and the thing you said a second ago is kind of a perfect description of the goal, where the creative director Jack Attridge and his company Flavorworks, based in London, they are very much trying to make something that broadens the reach of games. Like their target, I believe, if I can speak for them, which I can't, but if I pretend to, the goal is to kind of bring games in a digestible and understandable way while still being authentically a game to, like you said, there's still untold hordes of people out there that don't really know anything about games, never play them, don't know much. I mean, sure, case in point, the Journey Live that we just did in Colorado this past weekend, we did it in a kind of performing arts center that has unusual shows on a regular basis. So they have a little nucleus of audience members that come regardless of what's there. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, somewhat elderly guy came up to me afterward and said, "Look, I've literally never once in my life played any game. I had no idea that games could be this. And I was just mesmerized through the whole show, and, you know, thanks for coming," or something like that. And I was like, oh man, that is my dream audience member. I love when people show up who are like wearing Journey shirts and, you know, or scarves and that kind of thing and super passionate. But I love preaching to the unconverted, as it were, even more, because to me, games, I mean, I'm sure you would agree. I mean, it's just the most unbelievably compelling art form. And I think it'll be, by the end of the 21st century, it will at least match the kind of cultural impact that film had on the 20th century. We still have a long way to go to reach that. But I think by the end of this century, it could very easily be just as or more omnipresent as films have been up till now. And so any little part I can play in that to kind of evangelize on behalf of games as a medium I believe in so much, I'm always happy to do. So yeah, all that said, as my apparently extensive preamble, the Erica is a game. The sort of basics of the story is that it follows a young girl who has grown up with a kind of traumatic childhood, you know, memories of a traumatic childhood and surviving, sort of witnessing or quasi witnessing the murder of her father and never really knowing her mother. So she's kind of this adrift, broken, lost, not weak, mind you, but just kind of traumatized, young woman. And the sort of opening of the story is that, there's this horrible thing that happens where somebody, she basically opens up her door and finds a package mailed to her with a severed hand in it. And the police investigation that begins kind of launches her down this road of discovering more about her own childhood memories and the potential connection between whatever crime has just been committed and the unsolved crime of her father's murder. And it's a lot of this kind of intrigue and paranoia thriller type stuff, really, really well executed. You know, like I mentioned before about the kind of a comparison to Bandersnatch, one of the strengths of something like that and Black Mirror in general is just the incredible caliber of the filmmaking. Uh-huh. And the FMV genre, as I'm sure you'd agree, part of the reason why it's kind of a junk genre by default is because so much of it, the filmmaking half of it was terrible. They were just badly made with bad actors and people who basically pairing together filmmakers who didn't understand games with game designers who didn't understand filmmaking.
Right.
And so you end up with just the worst possible of both. And it's just doomed from the start. It's just a terrible premise. But this is really quite the opposite. You have really savvy, curious, interesting game designers who understand film and hired, you know, they're teaming up with filmmakers who are gamers and that kind of thing. Right. And you can feel it when playing it. I visited the set while they were shooting and I could see it plainly. Like these people all understand each other. They have to kind of form two teams that focus on their individual specialty, but they actually are one team really, which was so cool. So yeah, that's my little attempt at a spoiler-free description of the of the game.
You know, I can't speak for Patrick, but when I think of what people think of when they hear Austin Winery, they think, you know, kind of music that opens up the spirit, something like Journey or Abzu, stuff that can be kind of epic and heroic or tragic, like the work you've done on the Banner Saga. The idea of you stepping into, or again, I know you've actually done this sort of work before, but in terms of the popular mind and conception of your
sure,
work.
Sure, yeah.
Like the idea of you leaning into kind of very ominous music, scoring a work that is going to be, that sounds tense, that sounds almost like horror or horror adjacent. I think horror when I think about a hand appearing in a box in front of me. Not appearing.
I just call that Wednesday, but whatever. Okay.
Wow. Living a different life than me.
That's the beauty is like everybody might think of me, they might think that because Journey is pretty well known that I'm actually like that, but it turns out I'm the kind of guy that mails hands and boxes to people and I'm hiding in plain sight because of Journey. It bought me a lot of goodwill that I don't deserve.
I've gotten a lot of things from game companies over the years as promotional objects. Never got a hand, not yet.
You're making me think the marketing strategy. I don't know that they've realized that as a potential marketing idea for this, and so we're gonna need some very, very trusting volunteers to come down to the clinic, and we'll prepare our mail out packages. So, but no, what you're saying is completely. True. And I'm obviously kind of, I don't know, aware of that, I guess. I'm very lucky to have, I mean, anybody's lucky to have anything associated with their name. And I would never, the truth is, you know, I mean, Journey was a singularly life-changing experience and one of the best personal and professional things I could ever imagine being a part of. And if for the rest of my life, I'm like that Journey guy, I would cherish that good fortune. I mean, that's just, it's such a special game and to have been a part of it, I will never think, you know, ill of somebody who says, oh, wow, you know, Journey guy. And it's like, it's been 30 years, you know, that kind of thing. It was a really special thing. But you are not wrong. It does create the association and you can't help. I don't blame people for that. You can't help it. It's kind of like the reverse is true. A composer friend of mine, Jason Graves, did the Dead Space games. And it's like, no matter what he does, he's the horror. He's the king of horror.
Right.
And so it's like he did this little Sony VR game called Moss. And they initially were like, Jason, but this isn't a horror game. Well, you know, amazingly, I know how to not sound shrieking and violent all the time. So the reverse of that is I guess true here as well. And it definitely has some straight on kind of horror moments in it, but it's also a lot of ominousness and mysteriousness and it's great fun. I mean, it's something I've done periodically. Mostly I've done it in movies. I've done a handful of kind of indie horror thrillers where I've kind of worked that muscle more than the games I've done. It was fun. I mean, that's a whole other palette that's really fun to play with because it's one of those kind of anything goes playgrounds.
Yeah.
That's not true in most every other genre. And, I was able to do some some weird stuff, which I'm always on the hunt for.
Well, and it's kind of always the case. So horror is unique as, especially in film, in which music can itself be a character, which is often not the case with a lot of other, like where the music is there. It's to accentuate a scene, but you know, there's a reason there are so many sort of iconic horror themes, or if you think back to especially like 70s, 80s horror, like I think a lot of like watching the rough cut of the trailer for Erica, I couldn't help but hear some of like Christopher Young's like Hellraiser soundtrack, which is like very orchestral and loud. It's one of my all time, you know, I look for Hellraiser references in whatever I can find, but I like, you know, like that big bombastic, huge strings. Whereas you watch horror films these days, that stuff's receded into the background, but it was like very prominent in 70s and 80s horror. So I'm curious. Like was that fun where it was like, hey, in horror or like horror leaning medium or sort of a setting, the music can go a little more wild because it's supposed to be a little more upfront in a way that it's not always the case.
Yeah, no, I love Chris is actually a good friend and was kind of a mentor to me a long time ago. And he was working on he had just recently finished The Exorcism of Emily Rose when I came into his life.
Also a great movie.
And his, yeah, and the score has some major teeth, and there's a few moments that are really just nasty, and so yeah, being able to play in that space, I mean, it's just it's a blast. I wouldn't say the closest reference that I would make. It's funny, Hellraiser definitely never came up, but that's but I it delights the mind to imagine if it might have the two kind of references that I would point to as being potentially kind of similar, they were never things that we were overtly trying to kind of capture in our own way, but they exist sort of in the subtext. They're just kind of generally inspirational for us, I could say, is the nature of the sort of paranoia to the storyline and to the constant wondering of like what's real and what's not.
Yeah.
Gives it a little bit of a Hitchcockian twist. The thing is, Hitchcock, his collaboration with Bernard Herrmann has a very specific sound, like the Bernard Herrmann musical vibe of Psycho, North by Northwest, Vertigo. That's a very specific sound, and we definitely don't do that. The Herrmann-esque, like Bioshock has a lot of that, for example.
Yeah.
And we don't really go there. But I would say there's still that, even though we don't musically, the overall game has kind of a Hitchcockian tilt to it. But then there's this German film that the director and I both really loved. It's a German film, but it's in English with like Dustin Hoffman and Alan Rickman, called Perfume. That it was virtually unknown in the US. For some reason, it completely flopped here, but it was hugely popular in Europe. It's one of these bizarre asymmetrical releases where normally a film, you know, will make, you know, 100 million in the US and then all of Europe will match that 100 million. Huh. But this was one that made under 10 in the US, but then like 200 million in Europe. It was a giant hit overseas. And it's based on this very notorious German novel where the author had resisted letting anybody have the film rights forever and ever and ever, because he just didn't think it would be possible to even make a movie of this story.
Huh.
And because it's basically sort of a murder, a romantic fairy tale-esque murder thriller. You kind of think of like Pan's Labyrinth, where it's sure, fairy tale, but it's really quite dark.
Mm-hmm.
It also has that quality, and really beautiful score by Reinhold Heil and Johnny Klimek, and also co-written by the film's director, Tom Tykwer. This is the same director as like Cloud Atlas.
Oh, wow.
Huh. And he did Run Lola Run, and
okay,
so he's co-scored all those films as well with those two guys, and because they like have a band together, they used to at least, and so this score is super lush orchestral and has this beautiful kind of fairy tale sensibility, and then it'll zero in on these crazy creepy horror moments, but it does them with a kind of elegance. As opposed to the slash violent Chris Young kind of sound, which is just mm-hmm. raw carnage. And so we tried to kind of have the cake and eat it too and hit both in this. You know, there's moments where it's creepy in a hopefully kind of elegant way. And then, yeah, I kind of unleash hell periodically as well.
How do you find the
but
right
balance? But it's really not a horror game. So
how do you find the right balance between those two modes of, because, you know, obviously the narrative will guide you there to some degree. You know, there are certainly scenes, I'm sure, where you're like, oh, this is the one where I have to pull out all the stops. I can be as ridiculous and powerful and strange and scary as possible. But other moments where
Definitely.
Something more creepy will happen, or, you know, creeping is really what I mean. There's like, okay, is something mm-hmm. else happening here? Paranoia. But I'm also sure that there are scenes where you see the footage, you read the script, you see what the player's actions are, and there's a couple of ideas. You could go really heavy. You could be kind of light and subtle and almost insidious. How do you make those sorts of decisions? Is that gut? Is that experience? Is that something else?
Yeah, it's all the above. And the something else would be a really, really close collaboration with the game director, because there were a lot of times where I would look at a scene and I would say, you know, I see something really subtle here. I see a very minimal, let's just do a feather's touch because the performance is carrying it, or the cinematography is just so perfect. Mm-hmm. And I really don't think that the emotion is lacking before we've even added music, and I don't want to overload it. So let's just keep it simple. And then he would come and say, well, actually, here's the thing. I want this to be all about the subtext of blank, which is really not on screen. And I would say, well, that's a hell of a good point, actually. We can really make this scene, you know, something totally different than what it would be initially. Like, here's an example. One of the very first scenes in the game is after the character, Erica, gets sort of swept into this investigation. She gets brought to a kind of, like a boarding school. It's sort of you can think of it like a rehab clinic in a way. Okay. It's a place that her father had founded when she was growing up, and he was kind of the head doctor, as it were. And so she has a few scattered childhood memories of this place, but has mostly grown up pretty distant from it. But it has continued operation even long after his death when she was a kid. So she's kind of coming back to this place, you know, in her mid-20s, having not really seen it in 20 years since she was, you know, under the age of 10. And it's now it's like a treatment facility for sort of troubled young girls, almost like a mental hospital. And so a little bit sort of Shutter Island in a way. And so she, at the very beginning of the game, when you very first arrive, she walks into the lobby and there's a painting of her father on the wall. And she, you know, her father's been dead for 20 years right. And the trauma of discovering his body, you know, the opening scene of the game is this nightmare of her remembering finding his body before we kind of snap back to present day. And so here she is looking at this painting, and it was one of those where I kind of initially wanted to leave it pretty open. But then there was also this temptation of, well, you know, is it sad? You know, she's looking right. at the father she never really knew. But the game director was like, I think it's actually more, we can embrace the complexity of it, because it's also just weird. It would be very disorienting to walk into a strange place and under the circumstance of, you know, being whisked there by the cops after this horrible, like a severed hand is found on your front door. Like, so you're not in a good place. And then you walk in and then there's this oil painting on the wall of your father. And he was like, I think that it can be. We can be addressing the intrinsic weirdness and almost total unrelatability of that moment than trying to get all saccharine and say, oh, how sad she misses her father or something, which is actually really kind of cheesy.
Right.
But it's also
ideas?
Not creepy.
It's not right. It's not creepy. It's this other thing. So I guess that's my question is, you get a note like that. You hear a note like intrinsic, what did you just say? You said the intrinsic unknowability.
Unrelatability.
Unrelatability, like, no, right.
How yeah, do well, I it's not exactly a universal experience.
Like. No, totally. But for the viewer, something very strange has to be translated. So this moment for this other character, does that just spark ideas in your brain? Does that, like, or is that a thing you sit with? Is that a thing you go home with and you go like, all right, how... Okay, the intrinsic unrelatability of this weird moment. It's not creepy. It's not sappy. It's weird. Do you sit with that, or do you go like, I got six ideas. I hope one of them works. I'm going to go try them out.
Yeah, it's usually that. It's usually, ooh, you know, here's three or four things. I don't know if any of them are going to work, but let me kind of try to cook them up and throw them over the fence and see what gels. You know, this score is, it took, I mean, it's probably the hardest I've ever worked on anything because every single little scrap of music was like version 30 by the time it shipped. and not because the director was a pain in the ass. It just was a hard target to hit. There were always a lot of balls in the air and dialing back and forth between how emotionally subtle are we being versus how kind of direct when we choose those moments and how we pick those battles. It was really nuanced. And I think part of the reason why is you're playing a game. Like it's a Sony title. You're playing it on your PlayStation.
Right.
It'll eventually, I think, be out elsewhere, but at launch it's PS4. And so your hands are telling you you're playing a game, but your eyes are telling you you're watching a movie. And that's pretty unique of it's almost like cognitive dissonance. It's not normal for a game to make your brain click into this mode of I'm watching a movie and therefore I have all the expectations I would associate with a movie. You know, on a game, better or worse, part of the kind of youth of the industry, the fact that games are just so young still as an art form, is I think the gamers, we all, I say this as a gamer, we forgive a lot. We forgive bugs. We forgive, you know, jittery, or we forgive bad writing and bad acting.
Totally.
We forgive storylines that make no fucking sense whatsoever. because it's like, if only, at minimum, it's like, well, look, the story is stupid, but the gameplay is fun, so whatever. Like, films have no such lifeline they can throw out. It's like, if the stories and character and the production value all fall flat, then it's a bad movie. There is no other avenue to kind of appreciate it by. And so this one puts you in an interesting position because you basically have to rise to the level of film sophistication that most film goers have. But yet you are playing a game. So it's like you're kind of trapped in this place. And so that's the biggest reason why I think we wrote and rewrote and rewrote and rewrote the music 1,000 times over. It's a game playing by film rules, basically.
But given the fact that it's in sort of a pseudo game context as a composer, so in a video game, you're, to some degree, you know what the player is doing. Like maybe they're in a room, you know, generally the setup, but they may have control of the camera in which they've decided to turn it over to the left and they're going to stare at this rock texture while this really beautiful thing is happening, supposed to be happening in front of them, but they're not looking at it. And so as a composer, right. On some level, is it more comfortable to be, or I mean, you've done so many games, you've done film and stuff too, but like, what is it? How different is it to be like, all right, I know exactly what the player is fixated on. And so they're playing a game, but unlike most games, they can't necessarily control and change the camera. And so I have a better sense of exactly what we're kind of emotion we're attending to get out of them and what they're looking at in the moment relative to a game where you've given up some measure of control to the person with the controller.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I would say it's less about literally what they're looking at or the kind of nature of their control. The main way that you have the two principal ways in which the player controls what's going on in this game is constant dialogue trees and also sort of divergent pathways of where to go next. So, you know, an example is in the scene I was talking about a minute ago where you're looking at this painting on the wall, or not even you. That's another interesting thing.
Right,
it's never
right.
You. It's always Erica. She is very much the main character. And kind of like Joel in The Last of Us, he's you, but he's really not because he is his own guy and you're just sort of riding co-pilot in his brain. That's same thing here. Erica is a thoroughly defined human being that you have this kind of ghostly ability to manipulate, but not fully. And so, anyway, that scene where she's looking at the painting on the wall, immediately after that, there's like a little noise in the distance and she turns and sees, movement down this hallway. And then right in that moment, there's a kind of, like a host, there's a greeting, like a receptionist desk in the lobby. But it's really late at night. And so there's nobody there. And there's a little phone on the desk that starts ringing. So very quickly, you have this sort of wide angle shot where you can go pick up the phone or you can go down the hallway and investigate whatever little movement you saw, like people down the hallway. And that's two very, the game will branch into two very, very different scenes in that moment. Now, obviously gamers, we understand the basics of that. Although a lot of games will kind of let you do one and then backpedal and do the other. And sort of, you can usually it's kind of do everything, especially RPGs. Cause that's the way I tend to play. That's why it takes me forever to play games like that. Cause I can't just live with one choice. I have to kind of investigate everything. So it's like a game like Fallout, you know, I will just scour everything before I'll even remotely engage with the actual core plot, because I like to know the landscape, and this forces you down whatever choice that you make. There is no going back, because a movie couldn't do that. The only reason you would ever go back is if there's some organic reason why she would, you know, double back down the hallway and the phone would still be ringing. But in the case of this scene, that doesn't happen. And so it's like the scene just diverges, and it's like reality itself splits into two different realities from that point forward, like the movie Sliding Doors, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I'm kind of overanalyzing it, but the point is that because the character will constantly make these seemingly small decisions that potentially have big consequences, the score has to be just perpetually aware of that and always willing to kind of, you know, duck and weave with those player choices. And it's exhausting, because the other aspect of it is, I mean, the thing is, I think all games should do this, irrespective of if they're traditionally made games or not. But I think a lot of games, partially just because of the practical constraints of how much music you can just jam into them for all manner of reasons, but also because I think that it's just still a young industry, they have a tendency to cast this wide net. So it's like, if I am playing... I said Fallout a second ago, so I'll use that example. So let's say I'm playing Fallout 4, and in Fallout 4, you know, one of the locations you can go to is like the it's like the old fort, the kind of like Revolutionary War era castle. on the beach. Can't remember what it's called. It's been too long, but you know what I'm talking about. It's like one of the little strongholds. So like, let's say you go there, well, then the music will have a tendency to just be like, here's the theme of this location. Right. And so you can have a conversation with somebody that radically alters what you think is going to happen next, but the music is completely unaware of that.
It's
the music
heroic, is just patriotic.
It's just, it's just totally telling you, this is where we are, not this is what we're doing. But with Erica, the thing is, movies don't do that, because obviously the constraint of a movie, part of the reason why they do that on a game like Fallout is because it's like a 100-hour game and there's already, you know, 4 hours of music or whatever as it is. There's just only so far that you can go before it starts to become completely unmanageable. So I fully understand, and I've been in that position on projects myself, where at some point you just kind of have to call it and say, we can't get any more granular than this. It's just too much. We don't have enough time, or there's not enough resources, or, you know, the game, you know, the download footprint can only get so large with this much music, that kind of stuff. There's all these reasons why practical reality must interject and assert itself. But when you're watching a movie, movies are all pretty constrained. Like, if it's a 2-hour movie, then you know the absolute maximum amount of music is going to be 2 hours. And it's like pretty easy to draw fences around it. You know, so as a result, movies don't do that. They don't say, oh, well, look, we can only afford 30 minutes of music. And so we're just going to have like music. There's going to be a theme for this character, and we're just going to copy and paste that music every time they're on scene, screen.
Right.
Like, that would be horrible. And even the most uninitiated film viewer would see right through that and be like, what the hell is going on?
I mean, this is like, I think about the
feel weird.
The Imperial theme from Star Wars as this thing that in your head, you're like, oh yeah, they play that all the time. That's always playing whenever there's no, it actually isn't the case. They deploy that a few times in a Star Wars film. And then what they do is they build certain you know, motifs that show up in other places. And because it's a film, they can know that by the time they're ready to deploy the big guns, whether whoever's like main theme that is, whatever the big dramatic climactic encounter is, whatever that is, they've built up those motifs so that they can cash in on them. But when I play Fallout 4 and I'm doing the big whatever mission with the Brotherhood of Steel, I've heard the Brotherhood of Steel main theme every time I've been in their base. Or the other thing is, maybe I haven't. And that's kind of my question for you, is like, how as a composer do you count on or address in a game not knowing how often a player will have heard bits of that music? Is that something in Erica, with the kind of, you know, branching story and the way in which options do get closed out for you, does that change? Like, is there a world in which I haven't heard the set of, you know, the, whatever the riff is that's associated with Erica's father as many times as another player? Or are you, do you have to kind of like figure out a way
Definitely,
to make
yes.
sure? Okay, I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. Oh, no, what you're saying was a big... That was a big challenge, because you nailed it with the whole Imperial March thing, where by the time we hear it in, you know, like using that example, that theme really is hammered heavily during the Vader Luke Cloud City fight, in which he cuts off his hand. Spoiler.
Okay.
You've had 40 years to get your act together, so you know, I'm very pathologically anti-spoiler, but that one I think we'll let slide. It's like, you know, oh my God, Soylent Green is people.
You spoiled a second thing. Unbelievable.
Just like, I really think you shouldn't spoil things, but you know what? I'm just gonna spoil two things back to back and just make sure I'm.
You know, you want to know what Rosebud really was?
No,
also,
I will not. The Ghostbusters
cartoon.
You can't
cartoon, go for a trilogy.
The
We're
Ghostbusters cartoon already spoiled that for me when I was a child.
That's
and
hilarious.
So never
back
again.
When Egon was a blonde.
But yeah,
That's so funny. So the point is, during that very spoilery lightsaber fight, we are hearing the Imperial March in this very culminating kind of way, where you totally nailed it. We are hearing it where John Williams knew full well that he had planted that seed repeatedly, and now the giant, very imposing and menacing version of it has far more meaning and reaches us more kind of in this gut, visceral way, because it's not being, you know, trotted out for the first time as some novelty. And that's where, you know, great storytelling is all about structure, is all about really knowing. Like when you see an amazing stand-up comedian where they have this air of spontaneity, but the callbacks and the references make you realize that they know full well where they're going at any given moment, and they're right. Master storytellers. That to me is just the greatest art. And that's what I'm always trying to figure out how to do on every project I work on, even if it's, you know, the most open world, free, player agency to the max type of thing. I'm always looking for ways to subtly impose some kind of structure so that I can tell a story where A or B is the natural consequence of A and C is the consequence of B, et cetera, et cetera. Because that's what storytelling is. And so with Erica, you are absolutely right. There are things that pay off where you may not have fully seen the setup of it because you chose something different. And that, first off, that's a huge writing challenge for the developers to figure out how to not screw over their own story in the service of player agency, and how to make things sort of, because it, like many, you know, almost like Telltale games, those will have these branches and then it's, and then they all converge again on the kind of core, and then it branches again and then it converges again. And Erica definitely has some of that as well, where it's not like it's this, you know, spokes on a wheel where the game starts at the hub and then you just go off in any direction and it's a completely different game. It is more like a movie where the beginning, middle, and end are fundamentally similar for players, but the sheer number of variations is pretty staggering on both big and small levels. So there's definitely a few scenes where I really had to pay off this big moment. And I thought this whole scene is technically optional. Right. It's really easy to not see this. So how do I make sure that I'm not underserving the player's emotional takeaway in other scenes where they don't have this one. And I don't, to be honest, I don't even know if I solved that, because it's just a systemic challenge to this kind of storytelling. So let's hope I did, but yeah, I don't know. It's tough. I mean, it took years. This game was really, really hard work. And that kind of is the epicenter of why.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, it's been interesting to see. We're starting, you know, I don't know if it's quite a pattern, but we're, you know, Erica comes after, you know, the sort of like surprise popularity of a game like Until Dawn, in which,
oh,
for
sure,
that is a, you know, a game with like deep branching past, and like that studio is now doing their spiritual successor, Man of Medan, I think is the name of it, in which they're actually building in, you know, oh, right, the way that people played this game was they sat around a couch and passed the controller and like role played different characters. We'll just build that into the mechanics of it. And I think what's exciting for people like myself, that other than, you know, liking horror and Until Dawn being like an interactive horror film, was it what Bandersnatch represents, which Erica represents, which is opportunities where you have people in your life that would theoretically like video games, but don't have the time to invest to get over the hump to enjoy them. And that's so like interactive fiction that allows you to bridge those two worlds, where it's like I could play Until Dawn with my wife because I could ask her what the choices were, and I didn't have to like have her figure out analog sticks and things like that that she just doesn't have the time for because we're raising a kid. And that's what like Erica, Bandersnatch, like they're finding ways to take what's so interesting about video games and meld them with different mediums in ways that allow like people to bridge interest between one another without necessarily feeling like, oh, this is a video game, which to some person might make them think that's too much. I don't know how to play video games like that. I can't yeah. do that.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously this motif has been with me my whole career, because that was sort of the MO of that game company also, that, you know, they, when we were working on Journey and Flow, even Flow at the very beginning, the kind of unofficial mantra for TGC was, we want to make games for people that don't know yet that they love games. And you know, it would be like exposing someone to a genre of literature that they didn't know they loved, you know, that kind, or that was always the hope. That's the goal. That's the aspiration with those. And Jack Attridge, the director on Erica, very much shares that thinking. His philosophy was, I want to try to find a way to bridge the gap to non-gamers who are not predisposed against games. It's like you just said with your wife the world is busy. There's complicated lives, and not everyone is going to invest 50 hours as, you know, Ezio running around in Florence rooftops because that sounds like a good weekend to them. Like a lot of people, I mean, even I've been a gamer since before I was even a musician, and my dream games now are like Gone Home and Her Story, because it's basically the amount of time commitment is watching an episode of Stranger Things,
right,
you know?
Right, yeah, right.
And that's totally. Just kind of, I've partitioned my life into these hour and 2 hour bite sizes. And so, you know, like last year I trudged my way through Insomniac Spider-Man. It took me like 6 months to reach the end of that game as a result.
and that's a shorter one of those games.
Yeah, exactly. It's because, and the thing is, I love those kinds of games. I just don't really allot as much time as they warrant.
Yeah.
And so Erica is, you know, with that and the nature of the mechanics, like with Until Dawn, very much trying to be this sort of olive branch to those sorts of people and to those that may not even sort of take games seriously, or who are curious but not necessarily passionate. You know, their dream, I know that eventually the plan is to have it available on mobile devices and things like that, where they can really, which was actually, that was how it originally existed. When I first got shown the prototype, which was way before the deal with Sony, it was an iPad game. Huh. And because he felt very strongly that it's all about literally touching the footage and connecting in a tactile way with the characters, where it's not the degree of separation that the controller brings and the physical distance from your TV that is sort of implied in that is less intimate than his goal. Obviously, the deal with Sony was a very positive one. And so it was like, okay, let's figure out a way to make this work as a console experience. But I think the plan is to eventually have it available on mobile devices, because that's such the way to reach people. Everybody has a smartphone or an iPad.
Right.
Or
there's a huge some audience kind of there. I think exactly. A lot.
So, yeah.
I think so much about these moments in my life where I've shown my parents. My parents grew up playing, didn't grow up playing games, but in their 20s, right? When they were, hanging out in cities in the 80s or whatever, right before they had me, they were playing.
That's what everybody
games.
Was doing in the 80s.
Right, hanging around
just
cities.
Hanging out in cities.
Yeah. They were playing arcade games. My dad had an Intellivision. My dad had gotten an NES. That stuff as I was growing up, games were all around, but somewhere along the lines, they stopped keeping up. They knew I loved games. They loved to hear me talk about games. Both of them still listen to this podcast sometimes. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. And I remember times of showing them things like...
It's going to be an interesting test.
we'll see.
Put them on the spot.
Yeah. Listen. I if they don't listen, that is completely fine. I am a worse son than they are good, than they are worse parents. So they are allowed to not listen to one of the billion podcasts I put out. But I remember showing them Skyrim or showing my... Even there was a moment when I showed my dad Uncharted 2. This is, obviously 15 years ago, 12 years ago now, whenever that was. And he
That's
was like,
hard
how do
for
you...
my brain to accept.
I know, it's really scary. He was like, how do you know where to go? And to me, I was like, what do you mean, how do I know where? This is a very linear game, Dad. This isn't even Uncharted 4 with the big open areas and the Jeep. This is like, clearly I thought, it was also the beginning of the game. I was like, well, the train, I'm going to walk down the length of the train. That's, of course. And I had to realize, again, this was like 12 years ago or something. Like, okay, wow, there are all of these skills that I've developed to understand what the game is asking of me that don't feel like skills. Yeah. They are second nature to me. You were talking a moment ago about when you play RPGs, you always check everywhere except for the actual objective. Because what if you miss something? What if they close off a door behind you? What if you need something? And what if they give you the antitoxin that you're going to need in the fight where the boss poisons you? You learn all of those sorts of skills over decades of playing games, or a few years in your young years of just intensely playing games over and over and over. But for a lot of people, they don't have that stuff. But what they do have is a familiarity with certain other artistic techniques that are across other media. And so something like, hey, this is an ominous sounding, a song, can communicate something with them using a skill set that they've developed, a literacy that they've developed from watching TV, from watching movies. And so I definitely think that, like, if that's your mission, you're in the right place, because you're literally building bridges with skill sets they already have just into a medium that would scare them. So I'm pretty curious about how Erica comes out, because that is the sort of thing I could give to a parent or someone who I know who knows that I like games but doesn't themselves play a lot of games. And hopefully, it sounds like something that they'd be able to connect to, just like Patrick, you were saying with Until Dawn.
I think you've all but taken the words right out of the director Jack's mouth, because he literally was at Develop in Brighton just this past weekend giving a speech where he made those same fundamental points. He said gamers have developed a set of skills that they intuit that if we want to reach bigger audiences, we have to get outside the bubble and realize, exactly like you said with Uncharted, we can't take the uninitiated, we can't take for granted that the uninitiated will intuit those things.
Right.
Like your Uncharted example is so spot on, where if I've never played Uncharted, I won't look at a rendering of like the jungle, the edge of the jungle, and intuitively recognize that as a boundary. I would just say, well, isn't it possible to just get out my machete and forge into the forest and just see what's in there, as if the world is just this infinitely expansive simulation of the real world. We look at that and we know that's a wall. It might look like the jungle, but we recognize that we're basically in a hallway. And Jack's whole thing is we shouldn't take that stuff for granted. That's how to reach more people. And obviously film is a great medium for that. We're kind of designing in a bubble. It reminds me of when I was a kid and I would watch like the, you know, Batman animated series or the X-Men series in the late 80s, early 90s, that era. I remember that there would be a shot and the disparity between the elements in a scene that needed to move versus the background sort of paintings so obvious that you would look at an establishing shot and you'd think that car is about to explode.
Yep. 100%.
Because you know it's drawn differently than the street. And like it's just clear, you know, and it, in a way it's like a weakness of it because it's telegraphing unintentionally. But that's the kind of stuff where, you know, if the game equivalent of that is somehow necessary to play the game, you shouldn't take for granted that everybody's going to notice that stuff. So yeah, Erica is very much built on maximum approachability. There's no way to lose, for example. It's not like the kind of game mechanics it uses have the traditional gamey tropes of high scores and extra lives and stuff like that. It's very much just extreme agency navigating through a story. Totally. And that should hopefully make it very approachable to people. And I love the idea of the group, like when mentioning Until Dawn, the group playthrough of, you know, okay, you get to make the next choice or I'm, you know, for the next 20 minutes, this is on me. Or even just people debating, like, what should we do? What should we do? Should we say that? Should we say that? And part of the fun of it is the game tries to never break any immersion. So dialogue choices are all, you have a very finite amount of time to make a response. And with almost no exception, possibly no exception, if you don't choose a dialogue option, the time will run out and she'll just say nothing. And all the other characters have to awkwardly react to the fact that she didn't answer their question or didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And so at every moment, you know, it's not trying to break movie conventions with standard game conventions. Like, you know, if I'm playing Mass Effect and I have to make a dialogue choice, I could literally sit there for eternity debating about what to say. And we just accept that that's normal. But if you're watching an actor, because the footage would have to loop or something in order to do that, that would be so obvious. It would break the immersion instantly. And so the developers were like, nope, that's just not on the table. We are not going to do that.
Huh.
And it really helps make it more real while still having complete in quotes, I guess, player agency.
Right. A lot of places for the players to interject what they want to do there. I am curious. We're going to let you go. We're going to let you get to the rest of your life instead of being interrogated by us. But you were talking about how.
Well, we're approaching 1 hour, so I think that's only 25%. But sure, go ahead. Give up early.
Wow. Damn. Oh,
now no more hand in the mail for you, sir.
No more. Oh no, we're failing. We're failing. Our
you
promise.
Got us. Oh no, we don't get the hand in the mail. What are we going to do, Austin?
So,
I guess you're just going to have to go back to thinking of me as the like emotionally delicate, spiritual guru.
Right. Uh-huh, that's you.
That's what someone who is that would say.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. Well noted.
Just going to reshoot.
You played L.A. Noire.
Going to reshoot all of Hannibal with Austin Winery as every role. My last
Some
question
do
for you.
Mistake me for Mads Mikkelsen.
Wow. It's so humble, too. You're talking about this.
I put the flaw in the Death Star. All right, enough. I will silence myself.
Unbelievable.
I know. Spoilers everywhere.
Everywhere. The you were talking about the medium being very young, and I'm curious, you know, part of a medium being young is that it's exciting because lots of people can contribute to what it is. And as someone who at this point has been making music for video games. You have a career. It is not just a thing where you've made one or two. You know, you have a Wikipedia page where you can scroll. You know what I mean? Like, oh, wow. You keep making stuff, it turns out.
I've never realized that as a metric for...
It's a bullshit metric I just came up with, but I think it's a funny one.
No, I love it. I'm going to go straight to the Wayback Machine and find the moment at which it required scrolling in the Wikipedia entry and decide, like, this was the day, that moment is when I have made it officially.
So my question for you is, who is not at that point yet, but you're paying attention to their music? People, who are you excited about who is also working in games, making music, scoring soundtracks, doing the sort of stuff you do? Is there anyone you're following, anyone who you're excited by right now?
Oh, God, tons. One of the things that I love about working in games, working as a composer in general, because this is true in film, it's true even in, I occasionally dabble in like the concert music world, like modern classical music, basically, writing for orchestras or string quartets or whatever. I dip my toes in there sometimes, or even like record production and that kind of thing. And so, you know, one of the things that's amazing about the 21st century is there's a virtually infinite number of places a composer can call home, and you can nomadically call all of them home. So, I mean, for example, a friend of mine, Ludwig Göransson, is just this, he's this unbelievable composer and musician. And he just did the seemingly impossible and won an Oscar for the score to Black Panther. And who, you know, there's only one other time ever in the history of cinema that a superhero, you know, the quintessential popcorn genre, was even nominated for an Oscar, which was John Williams' score to Superman in 1978,
Which is essential.
I mean, it's considered like as much of a staple film music as Star Wars or Indiana Jones or innumerable other John Williams scores, or just scores in general. And Ludwig managed to not only get nominated but win, and but astonishingly, a week later or a week before or whatever, he wins a Grammy for his co-writing and production of This Is America with Childish Gambino. And so it's just like, the guy is just a badass. And he's the nicest guy, extraordinarily humble. I remember I knew him very tangentially because his wife back then, his girlfriend, is the number one violinist I love to work with in LA, Serena McKinney. And she's always played concertmaster for me anytime I do recording sessions here in LA. And I remember I saw the movie Creed, which Ludwig scored, and I was like, man, what a good score that was. Cause it just blew me away. And the way that he integrated these kind of slightly R&B, you know, dash of hip hop songs into the score, I thought, here's a guy that really understands both sides of that fence. Like, this is a deep knowledge of production and also scoring and orchestral writing. And I was like, this guy could kind of do it all. And I loved the movie. I've always been a fan of the Rocky franchise, but I thought Creed was a truly brilliant next evolution of those characters, and just absolutely loved it. And so I remember we were working on something, Serena and I, and she was like, yeah, Ludwig's, he's actually in Senegal right now doing a bunch of recordings with these drummers for Black Panther. And I was like, well, I'll be very curious how that goes. And man, oh man, did that go well. So Ludwig, I wouldn't call him up and comer, although he's never done a game to my knowledge. He's someone I love being able to the extent that it even makes sense to, because I mean, my God, he's an Oscar winning composer. he's scoring. I mean, he's literally, Hans Zimmer is so tied up with Denis Villeneuve's Dune remake that he couldn't do Christopher Nolan's next movie, so they hired Ludwig for it. So Ludwig is doing Nolan's next movie, which is like a spy thriller or a World War II film of some kind, I think. I can't remember, or maybe a Cold War era spy film. I can't remember. I think it's called Tenet. But Ludwig's doing the gig, and he's going to do that right after finishing up working with Jon Favreau on the Mandalorian TV show. So he's just like, he's killing it.
Wow.
And so to the extent that I could even righteously call someone like that a colleague, I do cherish being able to do that, because feeling inspired not by someone 50 years older than you or someone who's been dead for 20 years. Like, my all-time favorite composer is Jerry Goldsmith. He's been dead now for approaching 20 years, 15 years, actually exactly 15 years, 2004. Jerry died at the age of 75. So he was like a childhood hero who was, he was this like deity from the beginning, because he was just in another universe as a kid growing up in Colorado and looking at the achievements of this composer even 30 years ago. He was this unimaginable, he was on this Mount Olympus that seemingly one could never reach. So he was a hero, but in the same way that we hero, like we idolize, you know, mythic figures. On the other hand, Ludwig, you know, he's a guy I see around. We trade emails every now and again, or we'll have a drink here and there. And yet I think of him in almost the same way from a respect standpoint. And so to be able to respect and admire a colleague is very empowering, because you think, there's nothing actually fundamentally that they're doing that I can't do. There's nothing out of reach. And this, when you're a kid, you look at someone like John Williams or Jerry Goldsmith or Danny Elfman or Bernard Herrmann, and you say, they are just not in my universe. They are so, they have warp technology and I'm like on a bike. And you just can't help but feel very separate from that. But when it's your colleagues, another good friend who I would say the same about is Bear McCreary. You know, he and I talk all the time, and yet I really genuinely admire him. Like, he's a friend, but he's someone I look up to in the same breath. And I love feeling that. So other people, I'll just rattle off names. People can go check out if they don't already know it, because there's so many composers I admire. Jason Graves, I mentioned before,
yep.
Composer of the Dead Space games. And he and I worked a little bit together on The Order 1886. And he did the Tomb Raider reboot and just tons and tons of games. Jessica Curry is a very dear friend and someone who I just think the world of. She won the BAFTA for Everybody's Gone to the Rapture.
Great.
Which I think is just like score. One of the next level. Oh yeah. It's like a score that made all the rest of us composers sit up and go, God damn, we better pay attention, because the bar just raised. And I feel the same about Gary Scheinman with the BioShock, particularly BioShock 1, but 1 and 3 are both, I mean, the two of my favorite games ever made, and his scores, just elevated them beyond the norm, even of a great score. I mean, they're just the transcendent bar setting quality works. Disaster Piece, who's done 10,000 indie games, but most famously like Fez and Hyperlight Drifter.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
He's just tremendous. Rich Vreeland is his name. Danny Baranowski, who just did the new Cadence, Hyrule.
Yeah. Fantastic.
But most noteworthily, I think, you know, Crypt of the NecroDancer and Super Meat Boy and Binding of Isaac. Danny is just phenomenal. Grant Kirkhope's been in the business for a long time. You know, Banjo-Kazooie and GoldenEye 64, Perfect Dark, and recent games like Yooka-Laylee. Grant is just, he's just wonderful. I'm trying to think of a good example of maybe someone that people don't know as well. Here's a name. There's a wonderful young guy named John Robert Matz, who did a game that I'm suddenly blanking on the name of it. I'm going to Google it really fast so I don't leave this hanging. This was a guy that it was kind of his first real shot at a game, and he just gave it everything he had, and you could feel that. It's called Fossil Echo. And I don't think the game was particularly wide of a hit, but he got a lot of attention within the composer community for his score, because it was just one of those where you could tell this is a guy who's playing to win. He really, 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 really wanted every last little note, every tiny little gesture to be all that it could be. There was nothing phoned in about even the tiniest details of that score. And so he won a lot of admirers within the composer community for that a couple years ago.
Also did some stuff on Gunpoint, the Tom Francis game, which is fantastic. Yep. So yeah, awesome.
Him and Ryan Eich. Ryan Eich's another one who was also the kind of the main Gunpoint composer, I think.
Yep.
And yeah, there's a lot. I mean, that's one of those things that there's kind of a spoil of riches. Every year I go to GDC, I walk 5 feet and I run into a friend or a colleague. And I'm like, man, this person's also really genuinely inspiring. And really, Lena Raine, a perfect, someone who I only recently came to know, who did Celeste, who, you know, before that, everyone hears Celeste, just kind of like our thing earlier about being known for Journey or a style, a specific style. Everyone hears Celeste and like, oh, okay, so she's another one of these kind of chiptune 8-bit style composers. And it's like, well, you realize before that she was on staff at ArenaNet doing orchestral music for Guild Wars. So she's no newcomer, no amateur, and she's also not a one-trick pony. So she's awesome. I only met her a couple months ago at GDC because of Celeste. But anyway, yeah, I could go on and on because there's so many, and now I'm going to feel like an ass because there's so many that I've
I shouldn't
not
have put you on
named.
The spot. Now I feel bad.
I know.
I will add people.
One last one.
Okay, one more.
Yeah, exactly. I will give you one final name of someone that is well worth their time. He's kind of my all-time hero in the world of games, which is Peter McConnell. He is most known for scoring basically every Tim Schafer game.
Okay, sure.
So he goes back to the beginnings of the LucasArts days and was part of the general sound team along with a guy named Michael Land and a guy named Clint Bajakian. The three of them were the sound and music of, you know, Monkey Island, Full Throttle, The Dig. But Peter was the sole composer of probably my favorite game score of all time, Grim Fandango. But he's doing, you know, he's working on Psychonauts 2 right now. He did all of the, what were those Fox?
Cy Cooper? Yes,
okay. Cy Cooper,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, I could hear that. I could totally hear that similarity, too.
Oh, yeah, he's got a real strong voice and identity as a composer. You can listen to just 1 second. I mean, you hear Cy Cooper, you hear Grim Fandango, you hear Psychonauts, and then you go play Hearthstone and you're like, this sounds familiar because he's got a very distinctive sound. And of course,
right, sure.
Blizzard hired a very inspired choice to hire him for that on Blizzard's part. So
awesome. Well, thank you for the reading list, homework you've given us. I was like, one more question. You were like, I'm going to get this 5 hours, Austin. We're going to be here the whole day. I'm just going to keep naming names. You're going to have to keep adding them to your Spotify account or wherever you listen to music. I have no loyalty to Spotify or anyone else.
This episode brought to you specifically by Spotify.
No, can I tell you the weirdest thing is, so this is complete like shop talk, but we are part of a thing where our podcasts go up on a service that has programmatic ads, which is like algorithmically like sold ads, which means there will be an ad on this podcast. Maybe if you might hear one, if the machine decides you hear one, and I won't know what it's for. It is the weirdest thing. It is like a way to get better rates or something. I did not pen this deal, but that is the world we live in now where we will record a podcast and it might be a weird local thing. It might be like, we've heard from fans who say like, oh yeah, I got an ad for a local comedy club, which is the strangest thing. So maybe yes, we did get a
this waypoint brought to you by Flappers and Burbank.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, let's spice it up. So I'm going to name drop some things. So Heinz ketchup is always in every is a familiar staple. Omaha steaks.
They got those.
Fan.
Anything else? Any other brands you're a fan of? Is there anyone else you want to?
I used to drive a Toyota.
Great. Good. I'm glad.
And let's just think. What's a real contentious brand that like? Ooh, Chick-fil-A always brings out the best in people.
We are not. And no.
And.
There are lines.
I look forward to the Chick-fil-A, Hobby Lobby.
All the bad ones. Wow, you're really digging deep. I can't believe you're doing this to me right now. You're the listener.
Just trying to earn you some scratch, man.
Oh, yeah, thanks, man. This is great.
God. Yeah, Blackwater, remember them? Halliburton?
Yeah, Halliburton, good. All the best brands brought to you. You know what? They would hate the association with us. That's the truth, is all of those companies,
they would be the ones who are like,
wait a second, who shouted us out? Ugh, give me my lawyer.
Yeah, exactly.
God.
Yep, exactly.
Well, on that...
All the proceeds of today are going to go to Ben Shapiro's Patreon.
Oh, my God. Oh my God. Thank you for completely understanding our audience who will understand the bit you are doing right now. And also thank you for giving us an hour of your time.
Bit.
That is I'm sorry. The not the bit. Bit is the wrong word. The
this is truth.
You of course will also be opening up a Patreon soon to share all of your opinions with the world.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yes.
God. All right. You're real talk. Watch your Twitter mentions now that we've walked down this road. thank you so much, as always, for spending time with us. Had a blast chatting with you. Where can people find...
If people
wanted to pay you money for your music, where could they do that?
Well, then I guess this is going to have targeted ads for Bandcamp. And what I especially love is that the whole last 5 minutes is totally going to be edited out. And so...
We'll see about that.
You're going to...
My
censorship. Yeah. Well, for anyone interested in the unedited recording of this from my end of the conversation, you can contact me via Twitter for the true story. No, Bandcamp, funny enough, composers and music artists in general tend to hate on Spotify.
Yeah,
I'm actually a big fan of Spotify. I love anything that kind of broadens the listener base and democratizes the barriers to entry. Because literally anybody can throw music up on Spotify. And so there's more hours of music on Spotify than like hours that humanity has existed in the history of geologic time.
And a lot of music.
That to me is amazing. Yeah.
The heartbreaking thing I think about a lot is like, I bet I'll never hear my favorite song. I bet there's a song out there that if I heard it would change my life. Would like sit with me forever, but there is so much. And listen, I have lots of favorite songs already. I'm fine. It's okay that this is the case. I'd rather live in the world where there is more incredible music out there for me to listen to than less. But it is mind blowing to me to think someone right now in Iowa or Kenya or Osaka is making music perfect for me, and I have no idea. I will never hear it because there is that much out there. Now that is the world we live in.
But you've also never had a higher probability of being able to hear it than today. And that's why
you're
I love it.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Both of those things are true. Yeah.
So yeah. If someone wants to support what I do, obviously Bandcamp, but one of the things that I like about Bandcamp is that it has a kind of Patreon-esque subscription option where you can get automatically every new album sent to you. And one of the things I like about that is I recently opened a private Discord server for those subscribers that just pay an annual thing. And I've been sharing unreleased works in progress with them to get their feedback. And because I'm getting ready to release an album of kind of back catalog stuff. It's actually an album of all rejected material from the last 10 years of my career. Mostly it's demos for jobs that I didn't get. And I realized I had hours and hours where I went all in, like I really wanted to get the job. So I hired out of pocket a full orchestra and to really show them, here's my idea with no compromises and no leap of faith on your part to kind of hear through the rough draft mock-up nature. Like this is the product. And then they're like, cool, thanks. We actually hired, you know, Bear. And, So I realized I have just like a million tracks of stuff like that, that was a joy to create, in which I have like, the premise sounds very jaded and cynical. Like, here's all the, you know, the swings I took and struck out on, but it's like, I feel so lucky. I've had the opportunity to swing as many times as I have that. And I feel also very lucky that the times that it does come through, it has given me the resources needed to be able to take those leaps later on these kind of outlandish over the top demos. And so I thought I should put out a compilation of that. So I've been using this Discord server as a way to like say, you know, what do you guys think of this? Is this, if you have no context for what this was written for, is this interesting to you? Right, or is it just a random piece of music that's not exciting and that kind of, so if anybody who hears is interested in that, I'm doing that through Bandcamp and Discord but otherwise, yeah, whatever, the normal Facebook, Instagram. I'm A. Wintery everywhere except on Instagram, where someone stole that and I can't get them to take it down. So I'm A. Wintery on Instagram.
Oh, wow. Owned. What are they doing with it? Are they putting up like dog pictures? Are they using it at all? Like they're just squatting it.
There's no usage of it, but it's a clone of my Twitter bio from like 5 years ago.
Amazing. Terrible.
And so it's like,
you didn't set that up by mistake and forget the password.
It was a drunken Instagram weekend. No, I have sadly no memory of that, which means very could be. It's like Memento, you know, don't trust his lies.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You're going to wake up tomorrow. There's going to be a box at the door. It's going to have someone's hand in it and their hand is going to be connected to a phone and their phone is going to be the login for that other account. And then you're going to look down and it's your hand. You're missing a hand in this scenario.
My God.
This is why they pay me the big bucks. To write stories.
Yeah, you should be writing. It's I need to hook you dreamy. Up with the Erica devs.
You know, it's very surreal, I like to think. It really plays with the viewer's expectation. So, you know, I'm just trying some new things.
I feel disappointed that I didn't have music underneath your kind of thrilling monologue describing that very M. Night Shyamalan type moment there.
Very big twist. If you want to score us something for that moment, you feel free. Thank you
again
so much for this incredible conversation. Patrick had to run off to do a different interview, which starts in a minute. So goodbye from him as well. Shout outs to Patrick.
He didn't say goodbye.
He said goodbye through me, is what I'll say, because he didn't want to interrupt you, which is...
It was like the tentacles around Brent Spiner's neck in Independence Day.
Oh my God, unbelievable, another spoiler.
Come on. That's like halfway through the movie.
It is like halfway through the movie. And it's a great scene. It's a fantastic sequence. So,
yeah, you're like, Data, my God. Back to Alien Tentacle Overlord. Goodbye, Patrick. And thank you. I appreciate the chat. Hopefully it won't be a static thing, that it's a tri-annual pattern.
Yes, we'll have to do this more often, please.
Yes, also, I would love that.
Briefly, is there a date? Is there a release date on Erica yet? I know, obviously, this will be coming out alongside some more material, some trailers, stuff like that. The announcement that you will be doing the score, in fact. But do you know if there is like a window of release date that people should know yet?
So my understanding is that August 19 or 20, corresponding to Gamescom in Cologne, will be all the things. It will be announced. It will be released. It will be trailers
awesome.
Will drop. I will shotgun everything. And that's when theoretically this embargo should lift as well. So that we're just trying to kind of reach the top of people's feeds through the blast, you know, the shrapnel approach.
Yes.
I'll be releasing my own, like the video I sent over. That's kind of a trailer for both the game and the score. And I've got other kind of little behind the scenes, and I'm actually working on trying to make, this is going to take a couple of months. Unfortunately, I wish I'd had this idea 6 months ago of, I'm filming myself giving behind the scenes about the score. And then we're going to put it in engine and make that interactive, like the dialogue options of the game itself.
That's very cool.
So so it's like, tell us about, you know, why this instrument or that instrument, and you like have to choose which option for me to answer with. I think it's going to be so much fun to shoot that. Probably very tedious, but in any case, yeah. So there's, I think August 20, everything, all that should just be exploding out at once.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on wrapping up what you described as a very difficult project. I can't wait to see what you do next. And as always, thank you again for chatting with us. We should try to do this at least once a year minimum. So let's see if we can make that happen. Let's see if we can, if you'll agree to it, I'll agree to it. Next time we can go even longer. I will block out a longer period of time. I'll make sure that anyone else doing a podcast, doing the conversation with me, doesn't schedule a different interview that might overlap
Patrick.
With it. To be fair, we both kind of, I had the idea that I was like, oh, Patrick should be on this. Patrick has such a good understanding of horror and music and all that. He should be here. So that's kind of my fault that I didn't have him clear his schedule earlier. But the point remains, next time I will make sure that we have as much runway as we could possibly need.
I think both of you underestimate the influence you have over my heartstrings and emotionally. Emotionally playing with me like that.
I know. I'm sorry. Yeah. I apologize. A deep and sincere apology from my heart, from one Austin to another. I hope you'll accept it.
That's true. That's true. As one of my own, this betrayal is just stings all the more deeply. So, no, all good. I'll let you go. I'm gonna get back to work as well. And thank you.
Thank you so much.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
We should all clap at 35 seconds, just once, a single clap.
Okay, I'm ready. It's happening.
All right,
let's go.
All right.
Holy, sounded holy bad. Latency.
But that's the latency. That's fine. It will be fine. This is a very weird trick, but
this is new. I never even knew about this site. It makes me think of BoJack.
Yes, 100%. Yes, that yes.
I love it. I didn't know that was real.
It's real. Uh huh.
You can scroll down. I look forward to the time.is cinematic universe.
you can scroll down, except there is a different version of this website that gets rid of ads. So there are two different versions of this.
You go to time.is/just, and that will be just the time, please. I don't need ads or quotes. The quote for the day, by the way, is act now or face disaster, which is ominous, I think.
That's going to be the tone. That's going to be the recurring theme of this podcast, I can tell you right now.
Perfect. Good. Glad to hear it. All right. I'm going to do a very short intro and then we can get right into it because that sounds fantastic. All right.
You better act now. I mean, you know what happens. So
disaster. All right.
Exactly.